The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers internships here locally and in 35 nations around the globe, as well as in Washington, D.C. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or online to hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Higher Ed and the Utah State Legislature. Our guest today will be Jason Perry, but first, please join me in welcoming Lisa Hawkins.
Welcome to the first event of the ASUU Civic Engagement Series. We are honored to kick this series off with Jason Perry. Jason unfortunately got his bachelor's degree from BYU, but he soon came to his senses and graduated from the University of Utah College of Law. Jason's resume is glowing, beginning like many of us with a local internship, and most recently boasts Governor Herbert's chief of staff and now vice president for government relations at the University of Utah. Jason has been named one of the 25 most influential business people to watch in Utah, one of Utah's 40 under 40 to watch, Utah Bar's Young Lawyer of the Year, and the FBI Director's Award for Distinguished Service to the Law Enforcement Community. Without further ado, please help me welcome Mr. Jason Perry.
It certainly is a pleasure. Is it all working? Microphone.
How about now? Okay, good. It's a pleasure to be with you all today. Thanks for the very kind introduction. Thanks for what you're doing on the Hill with us also. As you know, the students are very well represented up during the legislative session. We appreciate that. Our legislators love to see all of you. So maybe after today, you're all going to want to come up. Yes? You can recruit after today if you'd like. I handle the government relations part of the work for the University of Utah, which is a huge undertaking for us on the state level, but also on the federal level. So today I'm going to talk a lot about the legislative process, how that works, and I'm going to kind of see you kind of put yourself in the position of a legislator. Because I'm going to make the case today, after I describe the legislative process a little bit, for higher ed. Do you think the legislature cares about us in higher ed? There's probably more love to even give, right? There might be a little more. So if you don't mind, if you have some questions while I'm going through this, please just raise your hand. I'm told to state your name and then your question for those that might be listening. I have some slides, which I'll try to describe a little bit for those that might be listening later on as well today. But if you don't mind, I'll probably throw out a few questions for today, and feel free just to throw out some answers too, okay? Now, I'm going to start with this. What is your opinion of Congress? Is it high? Oh, come on. Really? Not so high? So on the low. Anyone out there going to make the case for Congress? If you had to put Congress up against the Utah legislature, just your general opinions, more competent than local legislature?
Yes.
Yes. Really? Okay, good. Oh, we have some no's in here. Both of them have very important purposes for us in higher ed, but a lot for us. Sometimes, just so you know, this is kind of funny, only I think it's funny. Sometimes you can take a poll about how you feel about Congress. Any of you follow this one? Did you see that one? Okay. It turned out in this particular poll, the beginning of the letter, they say, what is more popular, cockroaches or colonoscopies or Congress? Both of those became more popular. I don't know if you know this. Cockroaches and colonoscopies, all more popular than Congress. But just in case you thought it was completely bad, I thought the bottom was very interesting too. Because Congress did do better than the Kardashians, Lindsay Lohan, and meth labs. So people were thinking about this when they did this particular poll. I want to talk about a little bit today how this works with us in the University of Utah. And our legislature is convening right now. Did you know that? Okay, good. You all care about what's happening in the state of Utah. Who knows how long the legislative session lasts? 45 days of love we all get from our legislature. And I have to tell you, this year in particular, I think a lot, but this year in particular, our legislature has taken a very great interest in higher ed, but in us in particular here at the University of Utah. We spent a lot of time trying to help them understand why they should care about what's happening here at the University of Utah. And I want to talk about how we get to our funding. You know, we get a good percentage of our budget from the state of Utah. It might be less than you're thinking. as we get through this a little bit today. But I want to talk to you first about how this process works. Have you seen in the news how much money they have to give to higher ed? Have you ever read that? Or to the state generally? We have really three buckets of money that happen in all of state government. We have a transportation fund, we have a general fund, and we have an education fund. All of it comes out of those three buckets of money. And for higher ed, it's interesting because, for those of you who follow these things, there is a constitutional requirement that the state funds public ed. Did you know that? There is no such requirement for higher ed, which means when we come to the legislature every year, you always hear about the funding for public education, and higher ed is up there saying, you know, what about us? You were kind of important. And they say, well, we get, you know, we try to help you out as much as we can, but there is an absolute requirement that they fund public education. So all year long, our governor's office meets with all the different parts of the state government, meets with every state entity, sits down with the head of that agency and says, what do you need for the coming year? And by October, the governor sits down with the fiscal analyst's office, and they say, well, how much money do we really have for this next legislative session? And let me just ask, who has a guess? What do you think the size of the whole state budget is? Oh, come on. Are you a plant?
No.
You've been right every time so far. $13 billion. Come on now. That was very good. $13 billion. By the time we finally hit 13, we're feeling pretty grown up. You know, our state of Utah is doing exceptionally well. Not just are we doing well economically, but in terms of our tax base, we're doing well. This was how we hit the $13 billion. We're one of those few states that actually are showing surpluses, which is a, you know, I attribute all to the University of Utah, of course, and all of you as you go out in the market. But at the end of every year, the governor sits down and they figure out what the revenue will look like. And so they sit with the tax commission. And they say, you know, who's paying their taxes? You know, how much do we have? And we come up with two big numbers. On the screen right here, you see the 2015 state budget. And this is how much money we have in new one-time revenue. That's $132 million. That's essentially the amount of money that wasn't spent this last year. Okay, so they may have overestimated what some things would cost. Maybe some programs were shut down. Other money comes in somehow. That's the amount we have to spend. What's the interesting thing about this is, imagine the legislative session. This is sitting on a table, and it's a scrum for this kind of money. All right? It gets spent so many times during this legislative session. At the end, we find out who got their piece of it. But this is the prized money right here. This is the new revenue. This is what we see going for this next year that you can sustain on an ongoing basis. This is where you primarily see money going to public education, because we know that we have this much new revenue. This is what the economy has generated over this next year. So this $206 million is what our legislature and our governor will be talking about spending for the coming year. In our fund for higher education, this general fund and this education fund, these are two. We don't get any of the transportation funds. But for you political science majors, there was a constitutional amendment not too long ago which allowed higher ed to be paid for with some of those education funds. So these are the two funds we watch particularly. Yeah?
Do you still have the permanent school fund with dedicated mineral royalties for K-12?
The questioner is about funding for education through mineral royalties, and the answer is yes. All these counties that pull stuff out of the ground, there's a piece of these of those royalties that come to the state, to the education fund. Right again. I can't wait to see what you do next. Next, for this coming year, it looks like these funds right here will be going down just a tad, but the estimate right here shows us going back up the year after, which for us in higher ed and public ed is a very positive thing. So this gets to the next part of it. So the governor spends a whole lot of time putting a budget together. He has a lot of priorities, and in December he has a press conference where he presents his budget to the legislature. Did you all watch that? Go. I know some of you are staying up late. The governor presents this to the legislature, and what do you think they do with it? There is some committee. Mostly they just say thank you, because the governor doesn't control the budget, right? The governor can have all the priorities that he wants, but the legislature controls the purse. It's a very, very interesting point, because the governor's budget is very important for us, but for the legislature, they have to prioritize everything. And so sometimes they consider the governor's budget, and sometimes they have their own priorities that they will consider. I wanted to have it take a second. Yeah?
What's the point of the governor making the budget if he doesn't really determine it in the end anyway?
Yeah. The question there, what is the point of the governor presenting a budget if they don't have to follow it? A couple of things. One is the governor, as the executive branch, in theory, has the ability to sift through what's most important. Our legislature does want to know what the most pressing priorities are. The second one is the governor has what kind of authority at the end over budget? He's got some veto authority in these line items of the budget, right? So the legislature is not going to say, we don't care at all. And I'll be honest, they do talk a lot. When it's functioning the best is when there's a lot of communication. But they rely on him to help sift what the priorities are. And at the end, they also don't want him to be vetoing bills because he wasn't included. They don't want him to be taking a line item to the budget items either. So this is the checks and balances we've been learning about so much. So he doesn't control it, but it is still important. For us as state agencies, it's important because even the legislature doesn't have to worry about the governor's budget. When we ask for something, they will say, is it in the governor's budget? And if we say no, it's a good way for you not to get any further. See how this works? All right, you're getting some good flavor for it. Any other questions so far? These have been good so far. Right here on the state budget, this is a graph that shows all the sources of funds. I'll try not to stand in the way. There's a couple that I want to talk about particularly, because you need to see where all of this money comes from in the state. There's a lot of talk on the Hill about whether or not they like federal money, right? And some of you guessed, does our legislature by and large love federal money? They don't.
They should.
26.6% of our budget there comes from the federal government. But the question for our legislature is always this. If we are receiving federal funds and those go away, what happens? All right? Does the state have to pick it up? If they're paying for something and they no longer do, what happens? That could be something that happens with something, for example, like Medicaid. All right, which I'll talk about a little bit, but what's going to be one of the biggest items on the Hill is what happens with Medicaid expansion in the state of Utah under the Affordable Care Act. This right here is another one you're going to see discussed on the Hill this year, this gas tax. Have you been following that? It's interesting because the state of Utah does not have a tax that goes up or down based on the price per gallon of gas. Have you noticed that? So the price could be $6 a gallon. The state gets the same amount of money. So there's some kind of idea for this gas tax to be increased. It's a very difficult conversation in the legislature. I'm not going to spend too much time except to say legislature doesn't like to pass a tax. The last time we had a gas tax increase, I think most of those folks that voted for that remember the pain very well, what happened. But others in the legislature, including Speaker Lockhart, who will be coming here, I think, right at the end of the session, believes that this is a dying tax. That cars are becoming more efficient. Maybe you're not using these fossil fuels as much as we were. And so maybe that's a tax base that will be declining. So that's just an interesting point for you. But you're going to see that discussion here. And, of course, these are the other sorts of tax that go into the state budget. This is the uses of all the funds. And I'm just going to talk about a couple of these. You can see for the public education, about 30.1% of the state budget goes to public education. You all read these articles about the per pupil spending and the state of Utah is the end. By the time I get to the end of this thing, you're going to understand a little bit why that is the case. But all you see in higher ed is about 11.6% of the whole budget, all these uses. And in terms of our federal piece, 18.4% is Medicaid money right here, and then a whole bunch of other things from corrections to transportation. In terms of where the money goes, it's spread pretty big, and you can see where the biggest parts of the pie are, which are clearly right here, public education, higher education, Medicaid, and social services. I mention this right here because this is where I'm going to spend some time here shortly on making the case for higher ed. Some of you are already thinking about why that might be. This is what's happening with public ed. The governor's budget proposes $261 million of new funds, which $64 million of that will take care of 10,300 new kids coming into public ed. Did you know it's that much? You imagine, we're one of the few states that has, I'm going to show you the pyramid in a second, that has the kind of demographics we do, where every year we have that many kids coming into the system. Higher ed right here is going to receive about $105 million. For us, we receive funding based on two things. We get performance money and we get equity money. That's how all of higher ed, every college gets money based on their mission and equity. The equity part is very interesting because this is related to how fast you grow. All right, so if you have an institution that's growing really quickly, they may have some growth sorts of issues, and so the legislature tries to accommodate that in some way. And the performance is based on how well we are performing our mission. So you would fund a University of Utah and a Utah State University in a different way that you would fund UVU or SUU or Dixie, because we have a different mission. And so the legislature contemplates those missions when they do this kind of funding. So there's some money at least put in there by the governor so far, and you might guess we're going to try to bump those particular numbers up just a little bit. In terms of how we deal with the legislature, and they are good friends to the University of Utah, particularly lately, as we've been really trying to make the case for what happens here at the U. There are 104 legislators, 75 in the House, 29 in the Senate. And as we get into this next legislative session, I just wanted you to see what the makeup is. We have 24 men, 5 women, 24 Republican, and you know we had 5 Democrats in the Senate. Do you think it was more or less than that? Interestingly enough, most of the Democrats in the Senate represent all the areas right around the University of Utah. And you can see the occupations of these folks. Attorneys, bankers, dentists, orthodontists. We have more physicians in the legislature right now than we've had for a very long time. So, you know, and of course, I say that because several of them went to medical school here at the U, which we love. And of note here, for those of you, because I want to make a plug for you to run for office, 29 of those in the Senate started in the House. So the Senate is often known as a deliberative body. And in the House, they're also deliberative, of course, but many more people right there. And a lot of folks go from the House to the Senate at some point. I did this slide right here under requirements, just in case some of you want to run, because I'm going to encourage you to do that. All right, running for your state Senate or House is something that you might not think you can do, but you really should start thinking about it. Sam, you said you would, right? Okay. You do have to be a citizen of the United States, a resident of the state of Utah, at least 25, and a resident of the district from which you are elected for 6 months. I mention that because is that the same requirement that we have for Congress? No, right? That's an interesting point. You can be in Congress and live in a different district than you represent. Look at Congressman Chaffetz, right, to be one example of that. But that's not the case in our Utah legislature. You actually have to live in that district and be a qualified voter. And, of course, our members of the Senate are every 4 years, four-year terms. And so half of them, every 2 years, you get a chance to vote on half of your Senate. Anyone buying yet? You gonna run? Okay.
Anything less than governor would be an insult.
Okay. He's running for governor. We got the Senate ready for the rest of you, okay? We follow very closely the leadership of the legislature as well. This is Senator Niederhauser, who is the president of the Senate, and a fantastic individual. And we always try to make sure we understand what their interests are in all the issues we present before them. So if you go to the website, le.utah.gov, you can find out all you need to know about these legislators. I won't ask the question, but just in case some of you don't know who your legislators are, I know this group probably does. You go to this website, you enter your address, and you can find out who represents you, your senator and your representatives. So on that website, you can see what their occupations are, which is very important as you're going to lobby on the Hill. And you can see President Niederhauser teaches at Westminster. I'm not sure why we don't have him here. Can we work on that? Okay, good. Realtor, and then also the things that they volunteer, all the different organizations. Now, we follow the leadership of the House and the Senate very closely. And I want to hit a couple of these because they'll become more important as I go forward. So here's President Niederhauser. Here's the majority leader, Ralph Okerlund. Stuart Adams, graduate of the University of Utah, has a great U of U lamp in his office. And here's our dentist that I referenced before. And down here are our House members. This is the House leadership. So some of you are doing your math. There's 4, and there, how many did I tell you? So one person gets a break this year, but not for very long, because they're going to come back. So these folks right here, of course, many of you know Pat Jones. You all know Dan Jones, her husband, right? Have you had a class from him in the past? Some of you have. Just another great family right here. They all have these positions, majority leader, majority whip, and the assistant majority whip. We spend a lot of time working with these leaders. The House is a little bigger and a lot more people in it, and they're elected for two-year terms. So every 2 year terms of even numbered years, we have a good amount of people coming up all the time in our Utah House of Representatives. Someone has asked me in the past who the longest serving representative is or senator. It's Senator Lyle Hilliard, from Cache Valley, 34 years, I think, has been there. He chairs the Appropriations Committee, the Executive Appropriations Committee. Just a great guy also, but in case you're wondering who the longest-serving person was, that's him. And every 10 years, these get redistricted. Districted. That's how you say that, right? Did you all follow the last census? That's not gerrymandered. Okay, you finally got one wrong. Oh, yeah, just... every 10 years, we go through this redistricting process, and this is how we figure out who our the lines for our representatives. We follow that all very closely. And similar qualifications for you who want to run here. Still have to be 25, Utah resident for 3 consecutive years before you file for office. Okay, just for thoroughness. All right, this is the Speaker of the House. This is Becky Lockhart. Hopefully some of you have come to hear her present to Hinckley before. She lives in Utah County, and this is her last session as Speaker in the legislature. We're all curious to see what she decides to do. You can read in the paper as she tries to decide what she's going to do, but she's the first female Speaker of our House, and she has been there for a very long time in the legislature itself since 1999. She's been there in the legislature. This is the leadership of the House. This is all going somewhere, I promise, now that you're going to know all of these things. And very similar structure here in the House. From the Speaker, the Majority Leader, there are a couple people who have said they are interested in being the new Speaker of the House when Becky Lockhart leaves. Brad D is one, and this is one other one, Mel Brown. He's currently the chair in the House of the Executive Appropriations Committee. So we follow these very closely as well, and all of these folks right here are friends of the university, and we appreciate what they do for us. These are the committees that we work. That didn't sound very nice. We work with, all right, all through the legislative process and all through the year. This is the one that decides our budget, the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Did you know all this stuff already? This group controls everything that happens to us. All right, we present to them. President Pershing, the president of the University of Utah, has to go before this committee and justify our budget. If we want to ask for something, this is where we go. It's chaired by Senator Urquhart from down in Washington County and Representative Grover. I don't know if you know those two, but they've been very, very good to the University of Utah. And the second one right here is Infrastructure and General Government Appropriations Subcommittee. I mentioned that one because... this is where our buildings come from. If we want to have, I probably shouldn't use OSH, should I? Do you all have classes in this building? We keep this one, up. I'm not sure how we do, but one day I'm telling you, this OSH is going to be there. But if we want to say hypothetically get OSH fixed, this is the committee that we have to go to. We have to ask them for it. The question I have for you is, what if you have a donor? Say we have a very nice donor. Says I will pay for all of OSH. Just knock the thing down, right? Build a new OSH. Would we still have to ask the legislature for permission to do that? Assuming it didn't cost the state any money. They don't have to pay for the operations or the maintenance or anything about it. They still have to approve that. So we spend a lot of time with this committee. So all the buildings you have gone up, that are going up right now, I will just tell you, I think that not one of them has actually been paid for by the state recently. You look at the new law school or the dental school building or the Virginia Tanner dance group that's going up there, the Beverly Sorensen Taylor.
So the capital outlay budget for the state, capital projects budget, does not pay for buildings on college or university?
The question is whether or not the money from the state goes towards these particular buildings. What generally happens on buildings is once they are prioritized by our legislature and authorized for funding, some of that money that I mentioned at the very beginning, the one-time money, is set aside for debt service on the bonding. They allow us to bond for those things and pay for them over a period of time. That's what happens when they do pay for their buildings. Well, we still get the obligation of the state of Utah behind that bonding. But oftentimes the money doesn't come. The University of Utah is very good. We have very great people who donate to the university. Hopefully it's all of you will do when you're amazingly successful. And because of that, some of these buildings can go up. The only way we get some of these buildings is by that happening, because there are definitely limited state resources that can go to these buildings. We do have one we're asking for money this year that I'll get to at the end of this. But this is the committee that has to approve. The infrastructure committee has to approve every one of those projects. Finally, in the end, the Executive Appropriations Committee. This is perhaps the most powerful committee because they're the ones that prioritize the budget. We go to this group and say, please, we would like go to higher education appropriations when we say, we need some funding for this. If they buy off on it, they present it to the Executive Appropriations Committee, and then they have the final say over what happens with the funding. So our university goes through all of those steps. Did you know it was that much? Here's what happens after this goes through. The parameters for the budget are set by Executive Appropriations, and then all the subcommittees meet. The revenue estimates are updated in mid-February. I mentioned this because, remember that number I gave you for the new ongoing revenue? We don't know what all the tax numbers are yet. That's a consensus number, revenue number, but until mid-February, no one really knows what the actual numbers are. So most of this stuff is we're just trying to work on our best guess, and hopefully in February, the numbers are even better. All right. So that's why every year the governor is very optimistic about what those numbers will be, and the legislature is very pessimistic about what those numbers are going to be, and finally we come to some sort of middle ground on that budget.
So you have your revenue estimating conference only once a year then?
The question is on the revenue estimating. So the governor monitors all year long what the revenue estimates are going to be, and then and so does the legislative fiscal analyst office, and then in December is when they come together on a consensus revenue number. It's continually followed through until the legislative session ends. And then our appropriations, and then, of course, everything goes to the governor for signature or for a veto. Every bill has to go through them, including all the budget bills. Anyone have a big guess as to how many bills are proposed every year? Over 1,000, would you say? The answer is yes. Typically, we get over 1,000 up to 1,100 bills every session are proposed. And in case you're wondering how many of those are passed, somewhere around 600-ish every year are passed by our legislature. And some, even in our legislature, would say that's maybe too many that are passed. But sometimes we love those changes, particularly here. But yeah, I want to make sure you understood the magnitude of it. Do you think that it's important for us to have a return on investment to our state for higher ed? That's the state, in fact, in the legislative intent language. It is stated right here on this slide that we are supposed to provide a return on the taxpayer's investment and propose ways to maximize that return by providing students with the skills necessary to enter the workforce. You all are actually contemplated in the legislative intent of all of higher education in the state of Utah. So this is what we're kind of queuing on for this legislative session, is how do you provide ROI, return on investment for the students? Because, a lot of stuff, we go through a lot here, and hopefully you all go out and you provide, a great base, because if you do very well, then, you're going to give back to the University of Utah. But you're also going to give to the tax base of the state of Utah, right? I think that is the idea. You invest in all of us, and at the end, it comes back to benefit you. This is the interesting problem for the state of Utah. I don't know if any of you have seen this graph. We're one of the very few states that has a pyramid for our population. On the very top of the pyramid are the folks that are a little bit older, the 85 plus you can see right here. But every year as it goes down, it gets to the number of children that are coming into public education. So you can see we have an ever-expanding base of children coming into our public school system. So when you hear those numbers, why is our per pupil spending so low? It's because of this graph right here. There maybe isn't enough money with that many kids to completely change what happens. So every year, it's not like these get bigger. I mean, this one stays where it is as it goes up, and just the bottom part of the pyramid continues to get bigger. There is a point coming shortly. This is Pam Perlick, who put this slide together here at the University of Utah, that kind of shows where we are going with our age groups. So you can see right here, this is our 85-plus population up through 2050. But what we're watching very closely is the less than 5-year-olds. You see this right here? The less than 5-year-olds and the 5 through 17-year-olds, which is this blue line. So we have 998,000 people in the 5 through 17-year-old by 2050. You can kind of see, we have a very young population. And, of course, there are costs for those kinds of things. So I think that's just a very important slide to see where we're going. For higher ed, this is how well we're doing. We have and this last academic year, I don't know if you knew this, over 28,000 degrees came out of our universities. That's a lot of really smart people coming out, right? And of all of our institutions, we have 33,000 employees in higher ed. That's pretty serious, right? The University of Utah itself is one of the five top employers in the state of Utah. Did you know that? See, that's why they love us so much. We got so many people that are contributing to the economy. The lowest student debt in the nation and the second lowest cost per completion in the nation. I don't know if you knew that. So I'm going to get to the tuition in a minute because I know you're all thinking about that. But the cost per completion is very low, and we have a great education savings plan. So the next few slides are going to be, hopefully, consider yourself a legislator, all right? And tell me if all of these things are compelling. I won't ask you, but I'm just going to know that they're going to be, all right? Because we'll know at the end of the session if they're good or not. In 2011, when the study was done, the state of Utah gave $674 million to higher ed. That's a lot. But we turned it into $4 billion. So this is about a 6-to-1 return of economic activity. A lot of great stuff is happening from the universities. This is how many people just we employ. I don't know if you know, was that many? With us, the medical school, the hospital, almost 24,000 employees here at the University of Utah. See, are you feeling better? You're feeling good about the U now, aren't you? And about $1.6 billion just in wages coming out of the university, which is having a huge impact on the state of Utah. And we, in terms of research alone, I don't know if you have any research in here, always around $400 million a year of research money coming into the U from lots of sources, a lot of it from the federal government. But this is huge for us. And not only that, but it's being spent right here in the state of Utah. That's a huge economic driver. I talked about equity, where you try to see what schools are growing the quickest. I don't know if you knew this, but we finally have someone that's very close to the University of Utah. UVU has had tremendous amounts of growth in the university. They're all the way up here to 31,556. I don't know if you knew it was that big, as opposed to the U, which is 32,398. The goal of the University of Utah is not to grow. We're about 3% a year is the growth of the University of Utah. Our mission is much different because we're a research institution. But you can see the kind of growth coming into public and to higher ed, which all needs some kind of funding. So you can kind of see why higher ed has to band together. You can see the other research university, Utah State University, with 28,700. You see a lot of students in these schools. This is a serious economic force, but it has corresponding impacts in terms of the budget. And these are our smallest ones right now down at Snow College, just under 5,000 students. What's concerning is what's happened in terms of tuition. This is where I know you all will start to feel this. Last year was the first year where the state contribution was smaller than the tuition contribution. That's not been the case historically. As you can see, go back even further than this. I can show you back to 2002. The yellow line right here is the tuition line. The red line that you see up there is the state funding. So right here in 2007, 2008, which were good years for higher ed. The economy was doing very well, and you all know what happened after that. And the funding for higher education started to go down substantially. And sadly, the tuition started to go up a little bit. And that's finally crossed that line. And if you look at where it's headed based on the current trajectory to show you over time, in 2008, we were 37% tuition, 63% tax funds. This past year, in 2013, we were 51% tuition, 49% tax. And at the current trajectory, based on the Utah System of Higher Education, by 2023, tuition will account for 62% of our budget. And the state will be at 38%. This is a concerning trend for all of us, particularly considering there is a point, I know I'm preaching to the choir on this one, there's a point where the cost for tuition is no longer viable for all of us, right? There is a point where you get and you say, it's just too much. And we have to not get to that point because we need everyone to be in higher ed for reasons I'll show you in a second. In terms of how we relate to other states, just kind of want to be very thorough, right? We're making this pitch to the legislature. This is our number I just showed you, 51% coming from tuition, 49% from the state. But look at some of these other states. The state local appropriation, if you look in Arkansas, for example, well, you'd have to go to school in Arkansas, I guess, but 66% of that comes from the state. And you can kind of just see some percentages to show how we fare compared to others. And it's not been great. Across the country, tuition has been something the schools have had to use. Now that I said that, though, this is the part where I make you feel better about that. We are still third from the lowest in tuition in the country. All right? So as bad as it is, and I know that it is, and it's tough every time, this is how well we're still doing in terms of those tuitions and fees by institution in the country. So as much as it's been, we're still fairly low in terms of those particular states.
And it still jumps so far more, not just here, but across the country in relation to the economy.
Yeah, the question about it is how we're doing in relation to the economy. I'm gonna answer that question a little bit here by this graph. And this is really my favorite graph of the whole presentation in terms of showing the return on investment to the state. And it's why you all are so important right here. This graph right here shows the wage and the taxes paid by educational attainment. I don't know if any of you have seen this before, but in the state of Utah, sorry, right here, if you have less than a high school diploma, your median wage is just around $20,000. Is what you would make the median wage in the state of Utah. And of that group, they pay about $2,221 per year in tax. I just want to make sure you see how important these two distinctions are. And every part of increase that you have, it gets better for you and for the state of Utah. If you have some high school, or if you have a high school diploma, your median wage is almost $27,000 a year, and they're paying about $3,000 a year in tax. This line right here is the poverty line, which is around $29,000 a year, is the designated poverty line in the state of Utah. So you can see, if you want to really increase your chances of having a livable wage in the state of Utah, you've got to start going to at least some college certificates or bachelor's degrees. This is just a very important slide. This next one right here, if you have some college, you can expect at least a median wage of $30,000, $31,000. The bachelor's degree goes up all the way to about $42,000, and a graduate degree up to $60,000. Of course, this is the median, so all of you will be very high on that list. But this right here, the red line, shows the unemployment rate. If you have only a high school diploma, the unemployment rate for that group is about 8.2%. All right, those folks are not be able to find the jobs that they're going to need. All the way down to your graduate degree, which is about 1.4% unemployment. I mentioned that, and any economist will tell you, you know, anything under 3% is basically full employment in that category. These are people, I'm not sure what they're doing, but they're not really looking for work, all right? So you have those kind of graduate degrees in the state of Utah. Not only are they making the highest salaries, but they're also contributing the most to the tax base. This graph right here shows percentages. For the state of Utah, 28% of our population only has a bachelor's degree or higher. Did you know it was that number? 28%. And that group pays 48% of the taxes. You're buying off on it now, aren't you? You're starting to feel like higher ed is worth investing in, right? If you have some college certificate, which is 38% of our population, they're paying 40% of the taxes. And people with no post-secondary education, which is 34% of our population, they're only paying 12% of the taxes right here. So if you put those together, this slide is very important. People with at least some college or certificate, some trade education, are paying 90% of the taxes that goes to the state of Utah, which, as I started to tell you, is how we get funded, right? So are you buying it now? Higher ed's where it's at. You want to make money for the state, you have to have people getting these graduate degrees. They've got to get their undergraduate, you know, particularly if you want to go on, which I highly recommend, the University of Utah College of Law. Okay, that was just my plug. So we're encountering some things in the legislature where some, have you read the articles about the degrees to nowhere? Have you heard that? You've read it in the paper a little bit. Of course, we wouldn't say there are any degrees to nowhere. But we put together the next two slides to show that no matter what you're studying, even us political science majors like me, I might not be the best example. I'm sure you will be successful. But there are ways for even us political science majors to get work. And, you know, and not only that, we can contribute to the economy. So we put together the next two slides to show that regardless of what your education is, you not only can you get employment, but you're very important to our economy. From the education degrees, you can see the median earnings. About $62,000 is your median earnings for the graduate degree in communications, and $50,000 in the state of Utah for your undergraduate in communications. We just want to show there's communications or engineering. Do we have engineers in here? You guys are in good shape. Turns out the state of Utah, at least for right now, with these graduate degrees, not only high employment, but the whole spectrum right there is very important. I wanted to make sure, as we present to the legislature, the across the board, everything from STEM disciplines, their contribution to the state and their personal income. So you can see arts and humanities, if you have a four-year degree, even arts and humanities is about $40,000, which is, you know, better than that other graph I showed you, right? So whatever that degree is that you're getting, there are no degrees to nowhere. The more important thing is that degree, all right? That's what we've proven here with the research that has been done. And we've gotten from health to our STEM trades. And if you have a professional degree, this is kind of your average lifetime earning. This is you all will be, of course, much higher than this. But I just want to say your base, all right, the lowest right here. If you have a professional degree, your lifetime earnings will be somewhere, you know, just, you know, this gone up a little bit since I did this, just shy of $5 million during the period of time you're working. Down to your high school dropout, your whole life, that is kind of the average lifetime earning. Did you know that? Is that pretty compelling to all of you? Stay in school. All right? You can see how that graph, if nothing else, you can see right there, the value of staying in school. All right? There is a market reward for you getting those particular degrees. There are, of course, some benefits to higher education that I thought it was worth presenting. There are, apart from just the tax base, because you can understand that argument pretty well. I think we made the case. Hopefully you're all buying off on that. But there are also some other qualities that come with people who go to college. For example, volunteering in the community. I don't know if you knew this, but if you have a bachelor's degree or higher, that's about 43% of those particular people are volunteering in their community. Do you like this particular slide? Is this compelling to you? We want people to be engaged in their communities, and I don't know if you knew this, but there's a correlation between education and your contribution to your communities, your volunteering. If you have less than high school, you can see less than 10% are volunteering in their community. This right here is Medicaid participation. You can see, of course, if you have less than high school, it goes all the way up to about 38% are. So if you're not adding to the tax base, what's happening is maybe you're getting some of those resources from other places. So you can see on all ends of the spectrum, college is where it's at, right? I know you already believe that. And this was also interesting. This is a new slide that was recently presented to us. This is the benefits for our children. I know maybe not think about that so much. But just so you know, at some point, if you have a graduate education, the chances of your kids having higher math scores are substantially higher. I mention that because we are really pushing our STEM disciplines, the science, technology, engineering, and math. And this is the number one issue we're dealing with here at the University of Utah, people coming prepared. It's those math. Maybe some of you are in political science like I was because of the math, right? Not sure. But there is a huge correlation between education and the next generations of students. We want those students to start going to elementary school with some kind of ability to start doing math. And we know that in those households, there is a substantial math score increase if you have a graduate education. You see that right there? The average math score is right there on the scale of up to 50 or above 45 if you have parents that have some kind of graduate education. Questions so far? Oh, okay. We got a mic?
Tim Wells. With reference to the math, most of the more sophisticated university systems in the United States will give you credit towards your degree, for your undergraduate degree. If you've had 1 year of high school math, algebra or above, they give you credit, so you don't have to take it in college. Same thing with languages. If you've had 2 years of a foreign language in high school, you have that year's credit in what this does is it effectuates a lower requirement, which translates into an earlier or on-time graduation, as opposed to adding requirements simply to subsidize perhaps retirement of deadhead faculty or what have you.
We don't have any of those.
Okay, yeah. I've just heard rumors. Anyway, but if people aren't enrolling in math courses or what have you, but you still have the faculty in place for them, they have to be paid for. They're still drawing off the system. So if you make it a requirement, you then leave them in place, and of course, there's a need for replacement. Is there any possibility for the university, for those folks who do not yet have their undergraduate degrees, of doing that kind of thing, as they're doing it, as they have done for many years in California and many of the private universities and public universities across the country?
It's a
long question, but it's really essentially very easy. Less complex.
It's less complex?
Yeah, it really
well,
is.
So it's a very interesting question for us.
It's like AP credit in English.
Yes.
Do you follow me?
Yeah, it is. So we're trying to work on a couple of things in our high schools even now, and this is when we have to do it, where we have to start. The most recent study that I read said if a student, I'm going to go even earlier than your question, if a student gets to third grade and thinks that they cannot do math, they will never believe that they can. Did you know that? That's where it starts, is in third grade. And these math skills are absolutely essential for us at the University of Utah, since you already know. We don't provide math remediation. If you can't pass those math classes or you haven't by the time you get here, you're going to have to go somewhere else and finish those up and then come here. So we have to find some way to get into the public education system so by the time they get there, there's no remediation provided. And some of that is by providing our own contents and some of our own instruction all the way into elementary school and into high school in particular. Do you have a question? Okay. I wanted to spend any other questions before I go to a couple priorities of the U really quick? I want to tell you what we're asking for the legislature this session. And now that I've made the case, I know you're all willing to give whatever you would have to give if you were a legislator now. It is an open wallet. And we have three real priorities we're working on. One is a compensation increase. And the deadhead faculty, of course, don't get one, to your point. But since we don't have any of those folks, we are recruiting on a national stage. I don't know if you knew that, but in terms of the professors that we have, the researchers that we have, there is a serious competition for the best minds. Our job is to make sure you all get the very best instruction that we can. One second, I'll get you on that one. And if we don't recruit the best, or if we lose the best, it's a serious problem, not just for the university, but for all of you. So we are working with this, with the legislature on this. And then the second part, have you all been in buildings recently where the power's gone out at the U? I'm sorry. But I want to tell you why that is. Many, many years ago, the decision was made that we would pay a very small amount of money for electricity, and there'd be almost no money given by the state to maintain our electrical system. And that's what you've seen some roads torn up. That's why the power is going out, is we have over 50 to 55-year-old direct buried power lines on the campus with almost no money to fix them. So we've asked our legislature to help us fix this problem. And it's not a small problem. We are like a little utility here at the U. I don't know if you know this. We have the power comes to the university borders from Rocky Mountain Power, and then we take it from there. We have three substations here on campus. Everything that happens here is like a utility, and we have to have money to maintain that. So we've asked it's a lot. It was $99 million is the cost to fix that. And they've substantially taken care of that, and we're finishing the last few pieces of it this session. And then the one building we're asking for, and they'll take all the questions we have time for, is the old Museum of Natural History. You know the George Thomas building? This is the building we're asking them to help fund. This is going to be the Gary Crocker Science Building. Gary Crocker has put up a substantial amount of contribution for this particular building. We've asked the legislature for $34 million dollars for it, and we have raised almost $21 million of private money for this particular building. But this, for any of you who are in these disciplines, this will be the place for classrooms and research labs for biology, physics, and math. Because it turns out what our economy is looking for is not just biologists or mathematicians, but we got to be like math biologists or all these cross-disciplinary sort of things, which is going to go in this building. So I mentioned these three things, so you're going to hear about these in the news a lot. Okay, we've got like 2 or 3 minutes. send me some questions.
And if you have any questions, please wait for the mic and please state your name.
He hasn't had a chance yet, I don't think.
Hello, my name is Jamil. My question is, what does a university do if they're ever denied funding for a certain building or project or whatever?
It's a very good question. If the legislature, if we ask them for funding and they don't give it, the building does not get built. It's as simple as that. There may be a perception out there that if we don't get it from them, we'll just find another way. But there are a bunch of projects that are just not like that, particularly just purely educational buildings, which these are state assets. That's why we need your help, because they won't get funded. Sam?
Well, first, thanks for coming and addressing us today, Jason, and for the work that you're doing on behalf of the university and students. Can you maybe share a little bit about how students can effectively advocate for themselves if they wish to go up to the Capitol and how they could do that?
Well, it's a great question from someone who does it very well. The legislature does love to see students up on the Hill. So while we're going through the legislative session, I would invite you, you can get with me. Sam can take you. Any of our ASU folks can take you up on the Hill, because they're there often. The ways you get engaged are one is first understand what they're debating up there. If there is a bill that you're interested in, I don't know if you know this, but you can go testify in the committee. Did you know that? Does that scare you? You should do that. I have been in committee hearings where it seems like it's a done deal, and one very nice person stands up, goes to the witness table, tells the story, the unintended consequences of a bill, and the whole thing changes. All right? One person, particularly with the kind of representative democracy we have here in the state of Utah, can absolutely impact that. And the students are more impactful than anyone up on the Hill. So I would encourage you to first go up there, follow it and go up there, go with your students, but also start communications with your legislators. Go to that website I told you about, le.utah.gov, and if there's an issue you're concerned about, you write them a letter. You're going to be amazed how quickly they respond. All right, I know right now you're thinking they probably won't, but they will. All right, those are the ways you get involved. I think we have time for one last question. Is that all right?
So my name is Tony, and my question is simply, this, you sold it really well. So my question is why they haven't already done that. What are their points that they're making, so we can kind of understand the whole spectrum?
Uh-huh. So it's a very good question. Everything with a $13 billion budget is a balancing of interests. The legislature cares about higher ed. They care about a lot of things. And so by the time that you start dividing up the pie, it becomes very difficult. That's why that ROI discussion is so important, is we would say we understand how important these other things are. And they really do consider how important all these other things are. But the important thing is that if you have one precious dollar to put, where is it going to have the largest impact on the other side? And I think we're finding that balance right now. And I don't want to give the impression they don't believe this. But we have to make sure that if they give us a dollar, they know we are going to turn it into something for them. And it's just balancing of those priorities. And I will tell you in my final couple of seconds, I believe our legislature does care about us. They care about higher education. And we're so fortunate that they're as engaged as they are, because our needs are huge. But even more importantly, you are the ones that are going to impact our economy going forward. And the more we can let them understand that, the better. Okay, thank you, everyone, for letting me be here.